study, right? You can still reap the same reward that you would have if the person whose thirst you quenched was a believer. In a similar tradition, the Holy Prophet has been narrated to have said that if a man quenches his wife's thirst, he is rewarded for it. This is also one of the instances of that general law that we talked about in the beginning, and which was reflected in the tradition from Imam Sajjad, from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the virtue of quenching someone's thirst in Islam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
The spotlight. Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
It's the sixth day of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Tit for tat measures underway while more Ukrainians are fleeing their country. Ukraine's president says defending the capital Kiev is its top priority, while Russia has promised to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. Reacting to developments in Ukraine, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the conflict there is the result of U.S. and Western policies. He cited Ukrainian and former Afghan presidents complaining of Washington leaving them high and dry. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this edition of the Spotlight. We'll have a research fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Zamuela, joining us out of Budapest. Also with us will be independent international affairs analyst, Gilbert Doctorow from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me ask George this question. George, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted a few days ago that his country was left alone by the U.S. and the EU. Why did they betray Zelensky after Russia attacked Ukraine?
Well, just before I attempt to answer that question, I want to congratulate Gilbert. He was on few weeks ago with me, and he predicted that this would happen, and most analysts didn't. He did. Well, to answer your question, though, I think that Zelensky was allowed himself to be used by the United States as a battering ram against Russia. I think, unfortunately, that Ukraine was ill-served by the United States and its allies, And this was the inevitable outcome. There was any number of opportunities as the crisis became more intense, particularly when President Putin started speaking about the Russia's red lines. And it should have been clear to the leaders of the West, Macron, Biden, Blinken, and the Germans, that the Russians were serious. And all Zelensky really had to do was at least to make a show of going ahead and talking. They badly let him down. They didn't explain to him that Russia is very serious. Instead, they allowed Ukraine to posture and to make declarations, open declarations, that we're not even going to legitimize the leaders of the Donetsk and Lugansk republics, even though the Minsk agreement explicitly states that the implementation of it requires negotiations between Kiev and the representatives of the Donetsk and Lugansk. They didn't tell him this. They allowed him to shoot his mouth off in Munich about Ukraine becoming a nuclear power. And, as I say, they let him down very badly, and they let Ukraine down very badly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Gilbert, there are people who argue that Ukraine has fallen victim to the West policy, especially those of the U.S., and they argue that the crisis in Ukraine and the ensuing Russian war was instigated by Washington and its post-Cold War expansion of NATO toward Russian borders. What's your take? How do you see the West's role in the war in Ukraine?
Well, the United States, the foreign policy community in Washington, must be delighted that they have lured the Russian forces into a war with Ukraine, which Russia did not want. Mm-hmm. Back in December, Russia highlighted to Washington and to NATO its main concern, which was to sit down at a table and talk about changing the architecture of security in Europe, which for the last 25 years the Russians have found very unsatisfactory, discriminatory, and resulting in ever-increasing threats to their national security through the expansion of NATO to the east. So the NATO question was by itself the number one priority of Russia, and Ukraine was to a certain extent an exhibit A about what NATO was about, why NATO was a threat. Exhibit A has become the whole exhibit at the present, because the issue of Russian security has fallen by the wayside, which delights certainly the power elite in Washington. And yet that is not the case in the final analysis. In the final analysis, what is proceeding day by day in the Russian operations in Ukraine is an attempt to smash NATO to pieces. Because the credibility of NATO, the credibility of the United States, and its security umbrella to all of its charges in NATO is being put to the test. And so far, as your question indicated, the test is being failed by the United States. There was stated before the action began, and as a kind of bait to Russia to act, President Biden said that the United States would never send a soldier to fight to help Ukraine in any war with Russia. This was backed up by other NATO members, and it was perfectly clear that Ukraine was being set up for a disaster. But the United States had no interest in the welfare of Ukraine. That Ukraine is simply a tool that was being used to bait, and if they succeeded, to do great damage to Russian sovereignty and Russian national power.
I'm going to ask you a question about that too. Okay, now let me ask George about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's spokesman saying Monday that Western sanctions in retaliation for the invasion of Ukraine are designed to topple Russian President Vladimir Putin. Is the U.S. seeking regime change in Russia?
Yes, I think that's been a fairly explicit policy on the part of the U.S. They've been dreaming of a return to the Gorbachev-Yeltsin era, and they've been frustrated year after year by Putin. I mean, we know this from the Hillary Clinton the time, you know, that was in 2011, that they were clearly organizing protests in Russia. They want Putin out. The problem, I think, is, and I think this is a serious one, which is that there's a increasingly a mood in the West for some kind of a confrontation with Russia. There doesn't seem to be any of the restraint that used to animate Western governments. I mean, even, you know, Eisenhower in 1956 over Hungary, Lyndon Johnson in 68 over Czechoslovakia, and then subsequently, which is there are certain red lines that you don't cross. And you don't even want to start going on that you're going to get into an armed conflict, because that's just going to escalate into a very dangerous area. And unfortunately, too many Western leaders, such as Boris Johnson, and Liz Truss, and others, are talking openly about getting into some kind of a shooting war with Russia. This is so reckless, so absolutely disastrous, because I think the mood in Russia right now is that war, I mean, among the policymakers, that war with the West is inevitable. It may come now, it may come in 2-3 years, but it is coming. And I think that's a...
Gilbert, we also have a group of analysts who believe that the long-term goal of the crisis in Ukraine is to weaken Russia, you know, as part of Washington's willingness and crave for a unipolar world. Do you agree with them?
Well, yes, to contain Russia and to keep it down, that is clearly the objective. At the same time, coming back to the sanctions that have been imposed, which really match what was called previously the nuclear option, that is, devastating sanctions in the economic sphere, I think that the problem is that in Washington and in Brussels, they really don't understand Russia. They have with Russia as it is, analytic skills, the intellectual skills to deal with. The economic sanctions are very severe. I think Russia expects them to be, if she causes conflict, will end soon. The threats to Russian security and the regime or the government in place is not in that area. The issue for Russia is the Western press has misunderstood totally. And so forth. The Russian concern, the nature of the war as a fratricidal war, as a kind of civil war between two peoples that have a common history and very close relations and great number of intermarriages. Whereas I'm speaking about the Russian and the Ukrainian peoples. Mm-hmm. And for Russia, they have to proceed. The Kremlin has to proceed very carefully in its military operation, not to present mass slaughter in the American way of war, but to do surgical strikes, to destroy military objects, and to destroy those most radical and elements of the fighting forces in Ukraine, namely these battalions like the Azov battalion that is now surrounded in the Mariupol region, and destroy them separately without taking on the ordinary soldiers, all of whom have mothers and girlfriends and perhaps even relatives in Russia, or not to mention without doing significant damage to civilian infrastructure and to civilian people. So the Russian operation is working under constraints that have nothing to do with what Mr. Macron thought he was imposing on Vladimir Putin when they had their telephone call 2 days ago. Mm. Russia is proceeding with supreme caution, and the operation is taking longer and is more difficult than the American way of war, which is to march through with shock and awe and kill everything on your path.
And they call it peripheral damage.
Collateral damage of hundreds of thousands of civilians.
Right.
Yes.
Now, George, Russia's war on Ukraine, many believe, has revealed glaring hypocrisies and racism that Western media and governments are fueling. Let me cite you an example that caused great anger, at least here in West Asia. Maybe you've seen that CBS News senior correspondent, Charlie Diagata. He was reporting from Ukrainian capital Kiev on Friday. He said, I'm quoting him, "This isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan. It has seen conflict raging for decades. This is a relatively civilized, relatively European country." End of quote. So what is said is dehumanization of people of color and race and normalization of white supremacy, plain and simple, is it not?
Well, I think there is something of that, but you know, you could also say that the dehumanization of Russians, and before that, the dehumanization of Serbs, was nonetheless played an important role in Western thinking. There is clearly a feeling that the Slavs, such as Russians and such as Serbs, are, you know, you don't want to use the old German expression "Untermenschen," but you know, that's more or less what they think. So that's why, when you think of what Russia is doing today, is basically much, much less destructive than what the United States did in Iraq, what the United States did in Afghanistan, what NATO did in Yugoslavia. I mean, we've had 5-6 days, and although the media are trying to whip up hysteria about the horrific civilian casualties, they don't have much to work with. And basically, there hasn't been anything of the scale of those U.S.-led operations that I refer to. So why is everyone so indignant? Well, because it's the Russians. Russians don't have the same rights and prerogatives as we Westerners do. When we do it, that's fine. But when they do it, it isn't. And that's in the same thing goes by with all this lot of heated talk about violations of international law. Well, the United States has been violating international law left, right, and center. Yet never once has anyone tried to impose sanctions on the United States. Never once has the United States been banned from sporting competitions. Mm. Never once has United States oligarchs or very rich people been subjected to sanctions. So there's a very much a different set of standards that apply to the Westerners and to Russians.
Right. Now, on that note, let me ask Gilbert this question. Gilbert, the U.S. and its allies wage unprovoked wars and invasions in several countries: Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, Palestine, and Yemen. And this without any U.N. authorization. It killed many people. So are we witnessing a good war, bad war dichotomy here? I mean, how do you explain this hypocrisy?
Well, hypocrisy is the small change of diplomacy everywhere in the world. It has been and it will be. So I wouldn't be in a state of shock over the double standards. That's to be expected. And I don't think that in the Kremlin they are suffering too much from any of the sanctions. You'll notice that the Russians have not responded to these sanctions, other than the banning of airspace, right, where they responded at once, but to the nuclear options, attacks on the central bank of Russia and so forth. They have so far done nothing. And that tells you that they don't believe that these sanctions will long endure, and that they have in reserve compensatory sanctions that they are ready to impose if necessary. But there are no rush to do that. Now, what am I talking about? We all know that the BP has said it's going to divest its shares in Rosneft, which are about 20% of Rosneft and are worth at least $25 billion. They will take a beating on that, take a terrible loss, because it's hard to think who exactly, other than the Chinese, are going to stand up and present them with a check to buy their shares. That is the least of it. In the Russians, if they want to respond in like, can confiscate all of European property in Russia, which far exceeds in value whatever is being frozen in Russian assets in the West. But the Russians haven't been in haste to use those countermeasures, because they don't believe that this hysteria that we see today will last beyond a couple of weeks, during which time the problems will be resolved, including the whole question of Europe giving a fast-track admittance to Ukraine. Fast-track normally would mean 18 months. Ukraine, as it presently looks, will be lucky to stay in one piece beyond 2 or 3 weeks, after which it will probably be divided, reluctantly divided, by Russia, in collaboration with local people who are willing to work in and lead the new states.
Yeah. George, did you hear Gilbert's prediction? We'll wait for another 2-3 weeks and see if that comes true, too. Okay, that was my last question, of course, but you just mentioned it now. Now, George, let's talk a little bit about the way European countries have been welcoming Ukrainians and fleeing the war in their country with open arms, which is, of course, a good thing. But they did not treat refugees from Middle East and Africa in, let's say, 2021. They were fleeing wars in their countries, and those wars were caused by the U.S. and NATO. They were responsible for that. Can you shed some light on this?
Well, I think it goes back to your earlier point about hypocrisy. And if you remember, a couple of months ago, we had another bout of hysteria about this was involved Poland and Belarus. And the Poles were absolutely beside themselves over the prospect of 3,000 refugees or migrants or whatever you will, coming across the border from Belarus, and the EU was indignant about it, and NATO, and everybody condemned Belarus, and of course, by implication, Russia, that these people were on the border. And in fact, Poland unleashed a cold water hose. This was late November, so that's pretty nasty. And again, you know, everyone just blamed Belarus and Russia. So, yes, there's very much double standards, and exactly, it's, you know, even applies to Viktor Orban, you know, who's been the great champion in Europe of saying no to migrants. He apparently is welcoming migrants from Ukraine, and so that, you know, that might cause him some political problems. But yeah, I mean, I think that the Europeans are doing an awful lot of posturing. You know, there's obviously with the migrants, but with a lot of very heated bluster in regard to what they're going to do with the Russians. We're going to take on Putin in Ukraine. Well, the Europeans haven't heard a shot fired in anger, you know, for decades, for 75 years. So therefore, the only power capable of fighting Russia is the United States. So it's basically, they're not going to do any fighting. It's going to have to be the United States. And so far, the U.S. is you know, trying to tamp down this war fever, saying, no, we're not going to be setting up no-fly zones. No, we're not going to get directly involved. So I think the Europeans are behaving in absolutely ridiculous fashion.
Okay. Now, Gilbert, we have only 30 seconds if you want to add to your comments, especially your prediction.
Well, it's very difficult to be wise. The situation on the ground changes. I believe that Mr. Putin and his immediate advisors are extremely flexible and have been revising and will continue to revise both strategy and tactics depending on what they see on the ground. And so for us on the sidelines as commentators, it is extremely difficult to predict with any degree of reliability what will happen 2 or 3 weeks from now. But there are just some indications, as I said, that a likely split up of the Ukraine, supervised by the Russians, is in the cards. Whether that happens will depend on the rulers in Kiev presently and how they react to the Russian advances.
Okay, and that note, we come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Zamueli in Budapest, and Independent International Affairs Analyst, Gilbert Doctor in Brussels. I've been your host, Petr Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the position of housing in Islamic culture. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the position of housing in Islamic culture. We can see that in the Islam, it is emphasized on having a vast house or a big house. But this big house should be according to the needs. If there is a family of two people, the big house means it should be enough for them. If it is a three members family or maybe six members family, the house should be according to the number of the people and according to their needs. We cannot say a family of two people should own a house which, for example, have six bedrooms or maybe an extra rooms, which is not even the need of them, and it's just a waste. So Islam emphasizes on the right size of the house for the right number of people, and it should be in a way that it should look big for you and it should be enough for you in both ways. So it should be something mediate. So that what Islam talks about. But on the other hand, we can see, like in today's world, we see people are trying to make tall buildings, and they're making big, too big houses. And obviously, they're very much tall. When we look at the Quran, we see that in the Quran, Allah gave the example of the people of Ad. The people of Ad were those who used to make big houses, tall houses in the mountains. And they were proud of that. And they became proud of their houses. And they used to think that they're the most powerful people. But at the end, Allah punished them because of their arrogance which they had. Similarly, according to the Islamic teachings, if your house is the cause of arrogance in you, then obviously it is prohibited. And it is something which is not been desired by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, we need to look into the Islamic teachings and follow the teachings of Quran. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the position of housing in the Islamic culture. And we said that in the Quran, Allah gave the example of the people of Ad. Now, in the Islamic teachings, we can see that even at the time of the Prophet had seen a house which was too tall. Its building was too tall. And the Prophet was surprised by looking at such a house. And then he asked his companions that, whose house is this? And they said, like, it is one of the Ansar, one of the helpers who had this this house. And when that person, therefore Prophet stopped over there and he waited for him to come out of the house. When he came out, he said salam to the Prophet. But the Prophet, he turned away. He did not talk to him and he became angry on him. And then he left the place. After that, the Ansar or the helper who was the owner of house, he went to the other companions of the Prophet and he asked them, like, why the Prophet is angry and he does not talk to me? They said to him that the Prophet is angry because you have such and such a house, which is the sign of arrogance, which is more than what you need. And whereas there are other people who are needy in this town, in this city, and they cannot even own a room where you have this thing. So therefore, he went back, he demolished and the extra part of the building. And after that, when he came to the Prophet saw the house and then he became happy. Why? Because there was something which was more than that. And that's when the Prophet said that inna likulli bina'in yubna wa balun ala sahibi, that whatever you make, you build for yourself, there is something in the hereafter for which you are answerable. You will put accountable for that. And if This is more than what you need. It is more than your needs and what you require. Then obviously you will put accountable for it, definitely, because this is a waste. This is the waste of resources, the waste of energy of the people. And it will take you on the day of judgment. Therefore, we need to pay attention when we are choosing a house to live so that we can be free from the fire of the hell, and to not to choose something which comes under the category of waste. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Images may soon be a thing of the past if Brussels has its way and removes Russian-backed media RT and Sputnik and their subsidiaries from the airwaves. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator Ofcom asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship, and the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy, and that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that, really. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing, because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the Western youth in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, imploring them to learn about the Muslim faith from its original sources.
And one of the key things in the book he talks about is education. And when you have education, you're able to talk to somebody, even if you don't agree with their point of view, but at least you can converse with them. And I think that with the lack of education, lack of respect for somebody else, or lack of understanding of somebody else's point of view, results in violence or results in people taking the law into their own hands. We don't want that.
Translated into multiple languages, the 196-page book elaborates on the life of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam.
I think the book is trying to say to us, we need to relook at his life in the manner looking at social cohesion, looking at the concept of brotherhood, looking at the concept of unity, looking at the concept of how we should resolve our problems together.
1,400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and went on to change the course of history. For 1.5 billion Muslims, he is the last and greatest of that long line of prophets who have brought the word of God to humanity. Today, Islam and its followers are on the receiving end of some of the most vicious attacks, all for the appalling acts of a few.
It is quite overt, the paradox that Muslims are often accused of terrorism, whereas they're in fact amongst the prime victims of terrorism, because they do get attacked by fanatics and extremists all the time.
Prophet Muhammad laid the foundation for the religion of Islam that after his death developed a culture and civilization that spread around the world, inspiring hundreds of millions.
At a time when many in the West, under the influence of the mainstream media, see Islam as a violent, intolerant faith, it is hoped that publications such as this one will shed light on true Islam and win hearts and minds. Saeed Purizza, London.
He is referred to as the head of ambassadors in Iran. Salah al-Zawawi has retired after completing his 40th year as the Palestinian ambassador to Iran. He finished his tenure in January when he was succeeded by his daughter, Salam al-Zawawi. Here at the Tehran office of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the former Palestinian envoy was honored for his four decades of activities. Following the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran ended its alliance with Israel and officially recognized Palestine as a state. This was followed by shutting down the Israeli embassy in Tehran and turning it over to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Al-Zawawi was among a delegation headed by then PLO chief Yasser Arafat, who came to Iran days after the revolution and symbolically took over the keys of the embassy. Al-Zawawi is one of the founding members of Fatah political party and the second Palestinian ambassador to Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He has held the post since 1981. And before that, he served as the Palestinian ambassador to Algeria, Brazil, and Kenya. Throughout his career, Al-Zawawi took major steps to shed light on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which has been ongoing for more than seven decades.
After four decades of serving as Palestine's envoy to Iran, Salah Al-Zawawi is now retiring. But unlike any other ambassador, he's not going to live his retired life in his home country, as he's one of the millions of Palestinian diaspora who are denied the right to return to their homeland. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If passed, the Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK government the power to jail asylum seekers for up to 4 years if they arrive via sea routes like the English Channel, and others could be sent to a third country for processing and detention. The devolved nations Scotland and Wales have already rejected it as an anti-refugee bill, and people on the streets of London are demanding Westminster do the same.
They're putting legislation in protest in place so that they can put guns on our beaches. That's what they want to do, because the migrants that will be coming when the climate and the ecological emergency really begins to hit, we want to welcome and they want to keep out.
Britain's banks, its military, its companies across the world creating poverty, creating destruction and warfare, and when people try to flee from the consequences of that, Britain puts up fences, borders, guards to keep people out.
The bill also gives the government extraordinary powers when it comes to ethnic minorities in the UK. A proposed rule change quietly added to the bill will give the Home Secretary draconian powers over immigrants, first, second and third generation alike.
The fact of the matter is you can be born and bred legally in the UK, but if you have dual citizenship or can claim citizenship somewhere else, the British government might give itself permission to strip you of your British citizenship. In short, you're not British enough. You're a second-class citizen.
Once you are a citizen, you have the right to remain a citizen. I mean, there's many incidents. That young woman in Syria, that's such an important precedent. They groomed her. She should be brought home. She should be looked after. This is, in any other situation, this would be considered child abuse.
Shamima Begum was 15 years old when she left the UK for Syria, where she was absorbed by the Daesh terrorist group. As a second-generation Bangladeshi, she has been stripped of her citizenship and is still languishing in a Syrian refugee camp.
These are the most racist pieces of legislation we've seen in the UK in modern British history. They constitute a direct infringement on every minority's rights, giving the right for a politician to take away our citizenship and giving the government overwhelming power to decide immigration policy. We're resisting today, we'll resist tomorrow, and we invite the country to resist alongside us.
Under the new bill, the government would no longer have to inform someone they are about to lose their citizenship. This will make appealing the decision almost impossible. Rights groups say these measures are used mainly against British Muslims, but Black and Asian Britons also say they now live in fear. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Sunday, the 27th of February, has been described as a major turning point for the EU. Including fighter jets, the 27-country bloc is going to send deadly military hardware to Ukraine, which will be used against Russian forces.
For the first time ever, the European Union will finance the purchase and delivery of weapons and other equipment to a country that is under attack.
The EU has always labelled itself as a peace project. Analysts are now questioning this.
They release huge funds to buy these lethal weapons from their own industries and to supply belligerent groups to continue the conflict. I think it's absolutely shocking and it's funeral of the European project as such, because it's not more a project of peace.
Another package of sanctions against Russia and Belarus were agreed by EU foreign affairs ministers on Sunday. Some Russian banks are being blocked from the SWIFT financial payment system.
This degree of disconnection is carefully calibrated in order to create the maximum damage to the financial system of Russia.
EU airspace is being closed to all Russian aircraft, and Russian media outlets, including RT, are being banned from broadcasting in the 27-nation bloc. Also on Sunday, EU Home Affairs ministers met to discuss support for member states Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania, which have witnessed flows of asylum seekers.
We have already seen more than 300,000 Ukrainians are fleeing the country, coming to the European Union.
Meanwhile, all eyes are now on the Kremlin to see how it might respond to this latest set of measures. The EU is clearly taking a calculated risk by providing deadly weapons to Ukraine. But could this lead to the crisis spiralling completely out of control? EU citizens will be hoping the risk has not been miscalculated by the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they're happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and changes are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be cancelled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain where the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban takeover. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. The students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran's parliament is reviewing the details of the budget bill for the next fiscal year, starting on March 21st. The government's proposed budget stands at roughly $148 billion, some 4% higher than last year's approved budget. Lawmakers have earlier approved the generalities of the budget bill, and it's been a week now since the thorough examination of the bill kicked off in parliament's open sessions.
The government's cap on next year's budget is roughly $148 billion. Out of this figure, $60 billion is allocated for the general budget and $88 billion is earmarked for government spending. Parliament is making some revisions, especially in national development projects and infrastructure. We increased the allocated budget in these areas.
This time, the budget's examination process took longer due to the fact that lawmakers want to be as meticulous as possible while evaluating the income and spending in the country.
While Iran and the P4 Plus One are engaged in tough negotiations in Vienna over the revival of the 2015 deal, President Ebrahim Raisi says the budget bill seeks to promote a resistance economy that would not need to wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions.
Parliament says the budget bill was drawn up based on a no-deal possibility in the Vienna talks and the continuation of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
The proposed budget expects the country's oil sales to reach 1.2 million barrels per day, with $60 a barrel, which would earn Iran some $14 billion in the fiscal year 2022-23. Lawmakers reset this figure to 1.4 million BPDs, with $70 a barrel. Any agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks will immediately push Iran's oil sales up by at least 500,000 BPDs as a result of the removal of U.S. oil embargoes on Iran. But lawmakers say they will not wait for the fate of the negotiations to finalize the budget bill, saying any extra petrodollar will be spent for the good of the people.
We cannot waste our time and wait if the U.S. removes the sanctions or not. So we set the budget based on a daily export of 1.4 million barrels of oil through direct or barter sales and based on assumptions that oil prices will hover around $70 when in fact the prices are reaching $100. Any extra oil income will be saved in a National Development Fund.
President Ebrahim Raisi submitted the budget bill to Parliament in mid-December last year when Parliament approved its general outlines. Lawmakers now have 3 weeks to go over the details and fix the shortcomings of the budget to pass it into law before handing it to the higher legislative body, the Constitutional Council, for final approval. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
EU foreign affairs ministers held talks in Brussels to bolster the 27-nation bloc's second round of new sanctions against Russia over the Kremlin's military campaign in Ukraine.
Only leaders in the world who are sanctioned by the European Union, Assad from Syria, Lukashenko from Belarus, and now Putin from Russia.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has also been added to the sanctions list. The idea is to block banks in the EU from making funds available to the two key Russian figures. Earlier on Friday, EU leaders agreed sanctions on Russia's energy, aviation and financial sectors.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defence.
Outside the EU leaders' summit, union members staged a peace demonstration.
We don't think to have a war in Ukraine is a good thing for European workers and for Ukrainian workers. So we don't agree with the war.
Leaders from the 30-country NATO alliance held a summit on Friday. The big question is, could moves by the West stoke the flames and turn this crisis into a catastrophe?
NATO allies have and continue to provide support, military, but also different types of equipment to Ukraine.
US troops under the NATO flag have just arrived in Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. Moscow had requested less provocation from NATO, but it appears those calls continue to fall on deaf ears. According to some analysts, one positive fallout from the crisis could be greater independence for the EU when it comes to foreign policy. The point has been made, there will be a realisation in the coming months. It is dangerous and extremely costly economically to allow Washington dictate relations between neighbours on the other side of the Atlantic. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Afghans gathered to celebrate Eid al-Mabas, an important day in the history of Islam on which the Prophet Muhammad was chosen as God's final messenger and started his prophetic mission. Participants paid tribute to the Grand Prophet of Islam and congratulated Muslims around the globe on this holy occasion.
I congratulate all Muslims worldwide on the anniversary of the Grand Eid al-Mab'ath. Prophet Muhammad was appointed as a messenger to enlighten the world and instruct people how to live. He taught us not to accept slavery and live freely. Afghans have proved that if we follow Islam, no one can defeat us.
Prophet Muhammad, as the final messenger of God, has been the best role model for humankind. He had the best personality and attributes. Prophet Muhammad says that he was sent to teach moral virtues to humanity. He serves as a teacher and as a savior for all Muslims and humanity.
Addressing the ceremony, the speakers also emphasized the need for Islamic unity among all Muslims. They said one of the messages of the Prophet of Islam was to fight oppression, injustice, and devils.
We Muslim nations are obliged to follow Prophet Muhammad's path and study his teachings and thoughts. One of his messages to us is to get united. Second, he asks us to resist against devils, oppressors, and arrogant powers. That is when we will succeed.
Tuesday marks the anniversary of the beginning of the prophetic mission of Muhammad Rasulullah. Eid al-Mabas is largely commemorated by the followers of Islam around the globe. As a Muslim nation, Afghans take this opportunity to strengthen the bonds of brotherhood and solidarity. They say the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was a messenger of kindness, peace, and justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In the limelight. George Floyd's murder set in motion shockwaves that touched almost every aspect of American society. But under core issues of police violence and police accountability, very little is different. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Tim Arango and Julia Hayward. The piece is titled, Despite Uproar Over Floyd's Death, the Number of Fatal Encounters with Police Hasn't Changed. For a second time this year, a jury in Minneapolis has ruled against a former police officer for killing a black man. Like the conviction of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd, the verdict on Thursday, 23rd of December, against Kimberly Potter on two counts of manslaughter for the shooting death of Daunte Wright during a traffic stop represented an unusual decision to send a police officer to prison. And yet, despite the two high-profile convictions in Minneapolis, a review of the data a year and a half after America's summer of protest shows that accountability for police officers who kill remains elusive, and that the sheer numbers of people killed in encounters with police have remained steady at an alarming level. The murder of George Floyd on a Minneapolis street corner drew millions to the streets in protest and set off a national reassessment on race that touches almost every aspect of American life, from corporate boardrooms to sports nicknames. But under core issues that set off the social unrest in the first place, that is police violence and police accountability, very little has changed. Since Mr. Floyd's death in May of last year, 1,646 people have been killed by the police, or about three people per day on average, according to Mapping Police Violence, a non-profit organization that tracks people killed by the police. Although murder or manslaughter charges against police officers have increased this year, criminal charges, much less convictions, remain exceptionally rare. That underscores both the benefit of the doubt usually accorded law officers who are often making life-or-death decisions in a split second, and the way the law and the power of police unions often protect officers, say activists and legal experts. The convictions of both Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who was captured on an excruciating bystander video pinning George Floyd to the ground for more than 9 minutes as he grasped for air, and Kimberly Potter, strike some experts as tantalizing glimpses of a legal system in flux. Kimberly Potter's case in particular reflected the kind of split-second decision she mistakenly used her gun instead of her taser after Daunte